Les colloques du Collège de France.
Sorry, je suis désolé, but I'm going to speak in English because my French is even worse than my English. Well, thank you very much, Sylvia, Stéphane, Antoine, for inviting me here to this event in such a place like this, with a lot of colleagues and friends, and some of them not only friends, but also very, very extremely admired masters, no? Such as Roger Chartier, Antonella Romano, Simon Sather. Well, the aim here was to explore the limits and nature of the Enlightenment, no? Its public and universal dimensions. At first, I proposed to Sylvia to spoke about Mexican antiquities, but Sylvia asked me to focus on collections and collecting, which has received less attention in other presentations. So in the end, I decided to please everyone, including myself, which, as everyone knows, is the surest way to leave no one satisfied. My topic will be how certain images or set of images, this is a collection at the end, a set of images of American nature and cultures were formed, how they circulated, where they were displayed, to which audience, and for what purpose. During the second half of the 18th century, many initiatives in Spanish America sought to catalogue and showcase the richness of the American nature and the antiquity of its indigenous cultures. We have, for example, the set of scientific expeditions, mainly hydrographic and botanical, that traverse the Americas from Patagonia to present-day Alaska, a set that began in the 1730s with a geodetic expedition to Peru, as Neil knows better than we do, and concluded with the Malaspina expedition, or maybe, or rather, with the Humboldt's journey a few years later. No? At the same time, archaeological investigations multiplied, sometimes independently and sometimes in conjunction with the former ones. The geodetic expedition is a good example. No? Antonio de Ulloa, one of the two young Spanish officers who accompanied the French scholars, La Condamine, Godin, and the rest, left written descriptions of necropolises, huacas, and archaeological sites in the Peruvian coast. He included them in the historical account of the voyage to South America in 1748, following the account of the geodetic operations that confirmed or globalized Newtonian theories. Here we see Antonio de Ulloa doing the Newtonian gest, no? Flattering the earth, no? Asma perdui. Ulloa was a pioneer. In 1752, he founded a geographical cabinet, the precursor to the Natural History Cabinet, established some years later in 1701 from the collection of Franco d'Avila, a Creole collector based here in Paris. Ulloa also drew up instructions for gathering information on physical geography, mineralogy, metallurgy, and antiquities in New Spain, in Mexico. Obviously, if we think of archaeology and antiquities, the case of Herculaneum and Pompeii immediately spring to mind. No? Excavations began there in the 1730s and 40s, during the reign of Charles of Bourbon, who would later become Charles III of Spain, as you know, and who fostered archaeological studies in Spain and his empire. Needless to say, in the Anglo world, regards William Hamilton, no, as the founding father of archaeology, whilst the Germanic world points to Winckelmann, who published in 1764, the very same year Hamilton arrived in Naples as ambassador, Geschichte der Kunst des Altertum, no? History of Art in Antiquity, the book that is said to have founded archaeology and even art history as a discipline. Well, I have not come here to drop Iberian names that precede, no? The great stars of the Enlightenment, no? It is a very ugly, very common, but very ugly habit. Ugly, but sporting, I mean Olympic, in a sense, no? But maybe curling is an Olympic game, an Olympic sport, no? But the history of science is not, no? You know the score, no? Rather than remembering who came first, it doesn't matter, we are interested in highlighting the collective nature of scientific practice, no? As in the image, no? Anyway, a lot of naturalists and archaeological research took place in the Americas before Humboldt, before Jefferson, before Charles Wilson Peale, who certainly did not invent nature, paleontology, or museums. There is a wealth of literature on American ruins, as you know. This, just some examples, no? This splendid book, for example, edited by Joan Pillsbury, curator at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Some classics in the history of archaeology include reference to the New World, as in the case with the great Alan Snap. No? This is his recent and monumental book, Ruins. No? Of course, we have the work of some science historians such as Irina Podgorny, Miruna Achim, or Stefan Gagner, no, who is here today. No? There is also a great deal of literature in Spanish, surprise, surprise. No? In Spain, for example, we have the works of Paz Cabello, who was director of the Museum de America, el Museo de America, or José Alcina, her mentor, an excellent archaeologist, anthropologist, and historian. And what about the literature produced in Mexico or Peru? Well, I just mentioned Miruna, no? But in a few days, one of the finest archaeologists and historian of Mexican archaeology, Leonardo López Luján, son of López Austin, by the way, will be giving a series of lectures at the Institute of History, my institution. He's the director of the Templo Mayor project, no? American archaeology has, of course, a long history and was not exactly a projection of Neapolitan archaeology, a mere reflection, although there was an intense dialogue in both directions between what was happening in the Mediterranean, in Naples, in Sicily, and soon in Egypt, and the New World. The main archaeological discoveries of the second half of the 18th century in Mesoamerica were the Mayan ruins of Palenque. Here you can see it in the map in the interior of Yucatan Peninsula, the archaeological site of Xochicalco in Morelos, south of Mexico City, the pyramids of El Tajín on the near to Veracruz on the Caribbean coast, and the great Aztec sculptures found beneath the Zócalo, the main square, the Cuatlicue, the sandstone, and the Tizoc stone. Each one has a complex history of how they were gradually revealed, displayed, and even lost or concealed, no? Of how they disappear and reappear in an unusual context before diverse audience in a fragmentary, intermittent manner. The first reports of the Palenque ruins emerged in the mid-18th century, but it was in the 1780s that a series of exploration campaigns were launched by authorities to this city lost deep within the Chiapas jungle or Selva Lacandona. No? There were the expedition led by Calderón, Bernasconi, and Antonio del Rio, which produced the first records, plans, and drawings. No? It is interesting to note how the drawings created iconographic models that were copied and imitated rather than being based on direct observation, as has been the case very often in the history of knowledge. The drawings by Almendariz, the artist who went with Del Río, for example, serve as a model for those by Castañeda, the painter who traveled with Guillermo Dupé, the leader of the so-called Royal Antiquarian Expedition at the beginning of the 19th century. The fate and publication of these materials were highly eventful. Some documents ended up in Madrid, others in Texas. There are even objects here at the Quai Branly. Dupé reports and Castañeda drawings were first published, as you know, were first published in French and in English, no? They were edited by Lord Kingsborough in 1831 as part of that monumental work, The Antiquities of Mexico, which included Mesoamerican codices and prints, and which demonstrate the ruined him. Sorry. As is well known, Edward King, Lord Kingsborough, wanted to demonstrate the Hebrew origins of that cultures. You know? These hypotheses were commonplaces. Such magnificent architectures must have been the work of Romans or Christians who had crossed the ocean fleeing persecution by the Muslims, or perhaps of one of the 10 lost tribes of Israel. In 1840, the American John Lloyd Stephens and the Englishman Frederick Catherwood arrive. Their accounts and iconic images produced using the camera oscura transform Palenque, another Mayan archaeological sites, Copal, Tulum, into the remains of a civilization as romantic, as magnificent, and as lost as Egypt. Xochicalco is another good example, no? It's another archaeological site that emerged in the period. It is an ideal place for studying the astronomical knowledge of the Mesoamerican peoples and the cult of Quetzalcoatl, the feather serpent. The site was first described by a remarkable figure of the Creole Enlightenment, José Antonio de Alzate, the founder of the Gacetas de Literatura, a Mexican periodical. Alzate dedicated his work on Xochicalco, by the way, to the Malaspina expedition, which was passing through Mexico in that year of 1791. El Tajín, in the Caribbean, was another important site. Lost to the jungle before the Spanish arrived in the 16th century, the Pyramid of the Niches was described in the late 1780s by two colonial soldiers. News of these discoveries reached Italy via the expelled Jesuits, because the Jesuits were expelled from Spanish territories in 1767, and many, many of them settled in Italy, including the famous Clavijero, no? The author of the Historia Antica del Mexico. There, in Italy, the Jesuit Pedro José Márquez, another Jesuit exiled, published some works that brought the discovery at El Tajín and other finds to the attention of Europe. These other finds were the three large monoliths discovered beneath the Zócalo. The Zócalo is the main square when the viceroy ordered the paving to be renewed. The Great Temple in Mexico is situated beneath the Mayor Square, beneath the Zócalo, which is why the center of Mexico City has continued to yield discovery after discovery ever since. They are the Coatlicue, this one, the snake-skirted goddess, mother of Huitzilopochtli, a central figure in our cosmogony. The other is the Sun Stone, the Aztec calendar. And the other, the third, is the stone of Tizoc, the Tizoc stone, a large disc used in rituals to mark battles or sacrifice. The three sculptures were unearthed between 1790 and 1791. On all three enter the public eye through the usual channels. First, a pioneering work by a local scholar, the astronomer Leoni Gamma, also a collaborator of the Malaspina expedition. The aforementioned Italian translation by José Márquez, the expelled Jesuit, and thirdly, as expected, an exhibition promoted by an English naturalist, an antiquarian with a flair for a spectacle. No? I am referring, of course, to William Bullock, no? The owner of the Egyptian Hall in Piccadilly Circus, where one of the first exhibition of pre-Columbian art was staged, featuring large plaster replicas in 1824. Something else quite significant happened with the Coatlicue statue. After it was unearthed, it was displayed in the courtyard of the University of Mexico for some years. However, the authorities hid it away again, and it soon sparked a wave of devotion among the indigenous population, and they buried it to prevent idolatry. In fact, when Humboldt visited Mexico in 1804, he asked for it to be unearthed to him to see. We must therefore note first that the diverse discoveries of architecture, sculptures, and steel, made in New Spain, express the richness and problematic antiquity of the indigenous peoples. Secondly, we also have metropolitan and colonial policies committed to these questions, which nevertheless lacked continuity when it came to collecting, exhibiting, and communicating these findings. Soon came first the Napoleonic Wars, and then the emancipation of the colonies, two complex phenomena, which in any case brought many, many of the Enlightenment projects to a collapse. Eventually, we are left with a sporadic appearance and disappearance of objects, stories and images in different places and associated with different purpose. In other words, a fragmentary, intermittent presence linked to the wealth of antique dealers, scholars, spell Jesuits, pioneers of entertainments, and private explorers such as Humboldt himself or Stephen and Catherwood, the creators of the canonical, romantic and exotic images of the 19th century imperialized. Some of this was present in the second case I'm going to introduce, the painting, the tableau of the natural history of Peru, a unique object currently in the Museum of Natural Sciences in Madrid. This case also expresses the collecting zeal of Enlightenment policies, but also the discontinuity, the intermittence of the lights, if I may say. The Cuadro de Historia Natural, Civil y Geográfica del Reino del Perú is an oil painting measuring 3 meters, 31 centimeters by 1 meters, 18 centimeters, containing 195 scenes and 381 figures, accompanied by a handwritten text in pen comprising 23,000 words. No? The scenes and figures are arranged concentrically around the two main images, a map of the Viceroyalty and a picture of the Hualgayoc mine, its main source of wealth. From the inside outwards, that is from the center of the picture of the earth towards the heavens, toward the skies, fish, mammals and birds are distributed. The corners, here you are one, feature reptiles and insects. The text is a civil and natural history of Peru, similar to other texts José Ignacio Lecuanda, his author, had published for the Mercurio Peruano. The Mercurio Peruano is the major periodical of the Lima Enlightenment. Above, between the texts and the birds, 16 human figures representing civilized nations and 16 representing savage people are depicted clearly separated. No? Some of these are taken from the drawings of Tadeo Henke, a Bohemian naturalist from the Malaspina expedition as well. The painter of the scenes and figures is the Frenchman Louis Thibault, about whom very little is known. No? Here you can see his signature, not here, there, in the bottom right corner. We know a great deal, however, about José Ignacio Lecuanda, its intellectual creator, who commissioned Thibault and who wrote the length text inscribed on the cuadro. Lecuanda, the intellectual author, was a civil servant, an accountant, who had worked for 32 years between 1764 and 1796 in some parts of Peru, particularly the northern districts, which feature prominently in the painting. Lecuanda was a nephew of Bishop Martinez Compañón, a leading figure of the Peruvian Enlightenment and the man behind the so-called Martinez Compañón Codex, or Trujillo del Perú, a work comprising 9 volumes with 1,400 watercolors depicting the fauna, flora, inhabitants, customs and places of the northern districts of the Viceroyalty, Piura, Lambayeque, La Libertad, Cajamarca, Amazonas, San Martín and Loreto, this part of the northern part of the Viceroyalty of Peru. Well, the Trujillo del Perú was a visual encyclopedia of El Trujillo. The cuadro is also a kind of encyclopedia of Peru, no? A visual and textual work that was even intended to include at the back of the painting statistical tables detailing trade figures and revenues, tables that were never actually produced. Well, much has been said about the nature of this object. No? Is it the cuadro an illustrated text, a collection of images accompanied by words, a collection, a portable cabinet, as Daniela Bleichmar coined? Certainly, the term cuadro itself offers many clues. Painting, cuadro is a painting, is a picture, but also is a tableau in the French sense, as in Turgot or Condorcet, a cadre synoptique, a term close to un système der Natur in Humboldt, translated into French as tableau de la nature, and in Spanish too, as cuadros de la naturaleza. The cuadro, the tableau, the cuadro, is a synoptic and visual device conceived to render in a single glance the whole diversity and richness of Peru, a device similar to other synoptic and visual devices of the age. Obviously, I am thinking of this one by Humboldt, no? Another very, very famous tableau. No? In a sense, it seems to those, where is Wally illustrations. No? Viewed from a long-term perspective, it is also a halfway, it's my favorite definition of the cuadro, it's a halfway between Instagram and the quipu, no? That Inca device used for accounting, resource inventory, and the recording of historical events. No, we must remember, we don't we shouldn't forget that Lekuanda was an accountant. The painting, the cuadro, in fact, is a tribute, is an anthem to the diversity and richness of Peruvian nature. Look at the wooden frame itself, that Baroque cornucopia, a symbol of abundance. No? It is, of course, a response to Buffon and the Poe theories on the American nature weakness, and also to the ancient Ptolemaic and Aristotelian theories according to which the dried heat of the tropics prevented life, the preconception with which the first Europeans arrived in these regions of the world. As the first chronicles notice, including Acosta, life there was not only possible, but more fertile and more diverse than in any other part of the world. Anyway, the point here is that the cuadro had remained virtually hidden until very recently. In fact, Lekuanda commissioned it to promote his own career. It was a gift to the Treasury Department in the hope that he would be appointed chief accountant of the Viceroyalty of Peru, a position he did secure, though he was unable to enjoy because he died the following year. Thus, the painting arrived at the Treasury Department on Calle de la Aduana as a gift for the self-promotion of a civil servant who the following year was to be promoted back to heaven or to hell or whatever. It remained in the Treasury Department for almost a century, practically hidden away. It was transferred at the end of the 19th century in 1880 to the Natural History Cabinet, thanks to the mediation of Jiménez de la Espada, a prominent naturalist of the time. If that one is not Robert De Niro, it's Jiménez de la Espada. The cabinet was then just round the corner from the Treasury Department on Calle de Alcalá, as you can see in the map, above the Academy of Fine Arts. During all those years, I mean between 1799 and 1880, it was seen only by the lawyers, the engineers, and politicians who built the Spanish liberal state. At the end, in 1910, the collection and the cuadro were moved to the new home of the to the new home of the Natural History Museum, the Palace of Arts, that one, no? The Palace of Arts and Industry, where it stands today, next to the in the backside of the Residencia de Estudiantes. Anyway, between 1910 and 2020, over the course of a long century, the cuadro was scarcely seen either. For most of that century, the cuadro was hidden away either in the conference room or in the office of the director secretary, where those of my generation first saw it. It was occasionally only on display during one century. It was occasionally on display at two exhibitions. One was at the Botanical Gardens in the 1929, and the other was at the Prado Museum some years ago, an exhibition on Spanish American art, Tornaviaje, in 2021. After that, on its return to the Natural Science Museum, it was placed finally at the end in a public space, in a room intended to invent the Franco Davila collection, the old Royal Cabinet of Natural History. Well, what conclusion can we draw from these cases? Well, only very, very tentative conclusions given the diversity and asymmetry of the cases. Now, undoubtedly, we must remember that there were many and quite early metropolitan vice-regal and Creole initiatives to study the past of indigenous peoples and the American natural world. These were not merely a reflection of European enterprises, but local autochthonous expressions of very similar concerns. Furthermore, by the end of the 18th century, institutions related to collecting had been established both in Spain and its colonies. In Madrid were erected the Natural History Cabinet and the Botanical Garden, but in Mexico too there was established a Natural History Cabinet, a Botanical Garden, an Academy of Fine Arts, and the Minen College. No? There were also journals and periodicals covering scholarly or erudite topics, no? The Gaceta de Literatura in Mexico or the Mercurio Peruano in Lima. No surprise at all. There had been universities in Mexico and Lima since the mid-16th century. However, it does not seem unreasonable to speak of a certain failure when it comes to showcasing that cultural and natural wealth. No, a certain gap in achieving what was one called the accumulation of mimetic capital. Well, years ago, James Amelan, is an American scholar but based in Madrid for a long time. No, James Amelan wrote an article entitled "The New World in the Old," no, the absence of empire in early modern Madrid, about the problematic presence, or to be more precise, the invisibility of empire in the building, streets, and other spaces, and lucky of public display in the center of the early modern Spanish empire, the capital city of Madrid. Well, despite the Enlightenment efforts to remedy this void in representation, we may finish saying that there is a certain continuity in this discontinuity, no? In this intermittence, in this history of hidden, submerged, yet brilliant presences, which is the history of Hispanic science. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.